Welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club podcast of the May 3rd Forum featuring Andre Kolontzopoulos, CEO of Philip Morris International. I'm Warren Zola. The Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management, is one of the top-ranked CEO speaking forums in the world. Several times each year, Boston's business leaders gather to learn from CEOs of global companies, leaders from the top echelons of their fields, who welcome the opportunity to address an audience of their peers. Mr. Kolontzopoulos addressed members of the Boston College Chief Executives Club, letting them know how Philip Morris is radically changing its business to unsmoke the world and encourage the hundreds of millions of current adult smokers who would otherwise continue smoking cigarettes to change to better options. The event was hosted by John Farina, Managing Director of PricewaterhouseCoopers. Please enjoy this podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club.
Good afternoon, everyone. I have the privilege of introducing our CEO guest today and for hosting our CEO guest, Andre Kolontzopoulos. I practiced that a few times. Did I get it right, Andre? I'm good. Okay. In terms of Andre's bio and his background, I wanted to share a few things I thought you might find of interest. Andre was born in Greece. He speaks several languages. He holds a degree in electrical engineering from the Swiss Institute of Technology in Lausanne and an MBA from INSEAD in France. He's a veteran of Philip Morris, 30 plus years with Philip Morris in a number of various leadership positions. And in 2013, he became the CEO of Philip Morris International. And just to give you context, in that role, Andre leads a Fortune 100 company with $136 billion market cap, $30 billion in annual revenue, leads 77,000 employees, and they're operating in 185 countries. Pretty impressive. However, what I find really impressive about Andre is the massive, massive transformation he's taking Philip Morris through. Their goal is to create a smoke-free future. Their stated goal is to take cigarette sales to zero, so that $30 billion of revenue needs to find new revenue. So I'd call that courage of leadership. They've invested $6 billion in R&D for alternative products to cigarettes. I'm sure Andre will probably talk about it, but their IQOS product just received FDA approval this week, so congratulations, Andre, to you and your team on that. Their social media campaign, called Unsmoke, pretty much sums it up. So I found this on Twitter. It says, "If you don't smoke, don't start. If you do smoke, quit. If you don't quit, change." So pretty provocative for a cigarette company. At a personal level, I've had a chance to get to know Andre. I will tell you, he's a great guy. He's got a great sense of humor. You'll pick up on that today. He's extremely bright, yet humble, and very transparent. And one of the things that Andre asked me to emphasize is there's going to be plenty of time for Q&A, and he recognizes cigarettes are controversial, and any question is a good question, and tough questions, you're fine with that, Andre. So with that, I think we're in for a treat today. Warm welcome for Andre Kolontzopoulos.
Thank you, John, and thank to all of you for having me here. It's a true honor and privilege. What I would like to do today is to give you a little bit, I was asked some numbers regarding the cigarette industry or the tobacco industry, because I guess not everybody is familiar except that cigarettes are bad for you. And then I will explain what we try to achieve, why, and obviously the lessons we learned by transforming a company. Actually, we are still transforming, we'll always do. Transforming a product and also trying to change the views of all the regulators, NGOs, around the world. So there are three big buckets of, I would say, transformation we're trying to achieve simultaneously, Of course, they're all interlinked. And you will have enough time for questions. And, you know, I repeat what John said, there's no taboo question, okay? You can ask anything. To the extent that I can and I know, I will reply. Otherwise, I'll find the answer for you. So, you know, a few years ago, we set ourselves the purpose of achieving a small free world by offering alternatives that are much less, you know, harmful for people who smoke and also for the people around them. But just some numbers. Today, there are 1.1 billion people who smoke worldwide, 40 million of whom in the United States. And this number even is projected by the World Health Organization to stay more or less the same by 2025 at least, unless we have major interventions. And so far, all the interventions we had in cigarettes were regulatory and restrictive, from marketing to product, but we never offered, until very recently, alternative products to people. Before I go to this, I just give you some numbers. 1.1 billion people, 5.3 trillion cigarettes smoked every year, 40% of which in China, about 5% in the US, which is the fourth largest market in the world still. And the industry retail value is about $850 billion, of which 11% is trade margin, and 67 to 70% is taxes collected by governments, excise and sales taxes. So this is a little bit the statistics. Philip Morris International does not have operations in the US. Back in 2008, we separated the companies. We used to be part of the Altria group with Kraft Foods, if you remember, with Philip Morris USA, and then Philip Morris International. So today, Philip Morris International is not present in the US, and de facto not present in any material way in China, because China is a monopoly. So essentially, we are competing in the rest of the world, including China, obviously, in a market that I would like 2.8 trillion cigarettes, so roughly 55% of the total. And we have a 28.5% share of that market, so we're the largest company. And obviously, as leaders, I think we have certain responsibilities more than anybody else. So, end with the statistics here. I would say, coming back to alternatives, and I will try to generalize as possible. I think many of the things we try to achieve on this planet is to, from the sustainable development goals to climate change or anything. Essentially, what we're talking about, in my view, is four fundamental things. Explain to people how the problem is, which requires some form of scientific and political consensus on the definition of the problem. The second is offer them alternatives if they cannot completely abandon the habit. Offer them incentives that can be supply or demand side incentives without being very technical, fiscal, you know, regulatory, whatever. And the last is hope for the best, because it's not so easy to change human behavior. You know, before I go into cigarettes, just to remind, we talk about climate change. Well, we always, in understanding the problem, we use shortcuts. We say fossil fuels are bad. Oil is bad. Oil is not bad. Fossil fuels are not bad. It's the fact that we burn them to create energy that makes them bad. If we didn't burn them to derive energy, they would not do anything, because they were laying beautifully under the soils and the oceans until we discovered them for many, many million years. So it's combustion that is the problem. and it's combustion that is the problem in tobacco. Nicotine is addictive, but is the least of the problems in causing disease and premature death. It's the fact that where you take this rod and you light it up, the part that you see being red is the part that decomposes organic matter completely into carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen. Unfortunately, smokers inhale their carbon, but that doesn't create any other problem. Is the zone behind that, that is at about 500 degrees, and I'm sorry, I'm talking centigrade here, not Fahrenheit, so I cannot, I was reminded this by some look over there. So, at this kind of temperatures, organic matter changes and recomposes. For example, sugars can become formaldehydes or benzopyrene. And these things are carcinogenic, but they're also smelling and tasting nicely. When you do caramel at home with sugar, that's exactly what you smell, polycyclic carbohydrates. So the answer to the problem of cigarettes for the people who don't want or they cannot or whatever, they don't quit, is to offer products that do not combust, that heat tobacco at low temperatures or have a liquid like an e-vapor product with propylene glycol and glycerin inside to which you add nicotine and some flavoring, to pure aerosols that don't even heat. But that's the solution, and we've been working on this for many, many years before. So, but most people believe that the problem is tobacco, is nicotine. I'm not saying they are innocuous, but the real problem is combustion. And the FDA recognizes this, and many other regulatory bodies, and a wide body of science. Now the question is how you resolve this problem, okay? Because on one side, and that's where we started the journey. Starting the journey, we had to develop products, and we had to find a way to scientifically assess them so that we have enough trust and the regulators eventually have enough trust that these products have the potential to reduce individual risk and reduce public health impact. So, which are two different things, and I'll come to them. So the key here is to have a product that is sufficiently good for people who smoke to switch, because if you just give them a hot air with nicotine, I tell you not many people will switch, because people also smoke for taste, like we drink wine also for taste, not only for alcohol. If the product is too close to the cigarette, then you have still very high levels of toxicants. So we had to, the problem is when we started the journey, there was absolutely no standard. We started work on these products very seriously, following a work Philip Morris USA had done before in 2004. The FDA guidelines and rules came in 2008. So it was a shot in the dark, how you do it. And actually we decided that the only known pathway to regulators at that point in time was the pharma route, with preclinical and clinical trials and post-market surveillance. But there is a big difference, and many of you that are from, you know, the pharmaceutical industry understand. Mostly in pharma, you have a new molecule and you have to test for efficacy and side effects. Here you have a known product that causes disease and premature death. That is, if I use the technical term, abusive per se, because it is addictive, and you have to go to a product that is vastly better. So what is vastly better? 50% reduction in toxicity, 60, 80, 90, nobody had ever defined that. And how you do this assessment? So what we decided is to use as a gold standard cessation. It's not only us, the Institute of Medicine and many others have defined that the closest you are to the effects observed when people stop completely smoking, because we have epidemiology and clinical observations on this, That's where the closer you are, you're more confident you can be that you're on the right path. And we set up a completely new life sciences, you know, organization to do this with everybody coming from pharma. We used the classic, you know, aerosol analytics, in vitro, in vivo, human clinical trials, when we had the confidence that all the rest was okay. And at the same time, we use systems biology, understanding mechanistic understanding on DNA impacts, proteomics, and all these things that are pretty advanced sciences, in order to also see whether we find what we find in the clinic at molecular level. So that was the first setup, and believe me, that was much more difficult to do, and obviously more expensive for the people that are from this industry that develop the products themselves. And we knew very well, because of the past, that our credibility starts at zero, so the science should be as bulletproof as possible. Because, you know, there is a lot of controversy about tobacco science from the past, and, you know, as I say many times, I can't change the past, but this time, we don't have a second chance. So we have to get it right. And I think that's what we did. Took more time, but finally we developed a portfolio of products that range from what I said, a heated tobacco product, which received the FDA authorization, you know, 2 days ago for commercialization in the US. They're still evaluating the reduced risk communication on the product, but they need a bit more time. But at least they found it appropriate for public health as the statute requires. We have e-vapor products. You're more familiar with them, especially given the recent controversy in the US about, you know, e-vapor products and a particular brand. And we started commercializing these products once we felt we have the science, with a very clear view that we will not communicate to people anything about the product unless we have 2 steps of verification ahead of us. So once we had the clinical, we communicate them that the aerosol is better than cigarettes. And actually, if you take the heated tobacco product, there is an aerosol reduction that goes to the toxicity is reduced 90 to 95%. And we have to be very careful here because a reduction in toxicity or exposure to toxicants does not mean reduction of disease or risk. Only the problem is tobacco-related diseases take many decades or years to develop. So you can only use proxies for that initially, that are the observations you have in clinic, as I said, in cessation, without saying this is a cessation product, it's not. And then you need post-market surveillance in order to establish the epidemiology over years. Okay, so we avoid the confusion. But obviously, you know, they are definitely better than cigarettes, as a meme. And as they don't combust, they don't have, you know, any material impact on the people around you. Now, the second thing is how you convince people. Because I thought personally that when you go to people who smoke and you tell them, listen, you know, toxicity reduces, this reduces, and they will jump out of joy and switch. They don't. So we needed to absolutely change our approach. We come from products that are FMCG products, very transactional. People go to a retail place, buy the product, leave. Your interaction is at the point of sale, essentially. And with all the marketing restrictions around the world, essentially it's the retailer that talks to the consumer. In many countries, the manufacturers of cigarettes can't even talk to consumers. So we had to create a completely different way of working that now approaches what you know more from, I would say, somehow startups, with real-time work across the consumer journey with pain point improvement and a lot of hand-holding with the consumers. Because they need 2 to 3 weeks of staying with the new product and making sure that you follow up with them so they don't fall back to cigarettes. We know that after 2 weeks, if people stick to the new product, they switch fully. And from the 47 markets we're present today, IQOS, from the people who buy the product, 70 to 75% switch completely to the product and quit cigarettes, which is very high success rate compared to electronic, to e-vapor products, okay? But it requires a completely different way of organizing yourself and following up with the consumer. And it also, it's not only the consumer, it also makes financial sense since we're all CEOs here, because the cost of acquiring and switching is very high, because it's direct contact, and sometimes in countries with high restrictions, where you cannot use mass media, you had to have field forces on the ground talking to people, which is not the most scalable model, believe me. Today, this product represents 14% of our revenues, or after 3 years, essentially, of being in a limited number of markets. But in addition to the $6 billion of investment you mentioned, they represent 60% of any marketing and commercial and sales cost we have. And in the markets we're present, 80 to 85. Which, when I'm asked if I'm committed to these products, I don't know what else I can do to commit. I mean, the whole organization is focused on these products. So now, I think we got the product portfolio right, and history will prove when I was right or not. There is competition, obviously, and I hope there will be more, because we're the first mover and we decided to disrupt our industry. But others will move, and I hope they will, because then we can accelerate the whole process. But this is not enough, because that brings me to the second bucket. So, you know, our job is to explain to consumers what the problem is and then offer alternatives. But governments have a role to play. And as with any innovation, obviously, you know, regulators are very slow, very cautious, and in this particular, you know, industry, given the sensitivity, the controversy of cigarettes, all the emotions around them, it's even more difficult for people, you know, to move fast. But somehow we have a lot of paralysis and polarization. And there is a lot of work to be done by governments on supply and demand side measures, allowing a certain degree of communication. And I was very pleased that the FDA set some very clear rules in their order on how you do the marketing of these products, how you make sure and report who uses the products to avoid unintended use, how do you do all this post-market. Because going back to my principle, let's assume for a second that these products reduce the individual risk of the people who switch by 80%. Public health has to make sure that not now much more people start with this product, much less people quit, and everybody that has quit relapses again and uses the product. So it's all the deltas that you have to monitor to see that you have a positive impact in public health. Now, obviously, doing the math, if you reduce the risk, and I'm not saying any of these products is proven to reduce, just use a numeric example, not to confuse anybody. By 80%, you need big deltas in the rest in order to compensate. But all this has to be monitored, and we're very, very sensitive to this. The good news for us is that now, as I said, we are in 47 markets. We have 10 million people that use IQOS, and as our monitoring shows, no red flag among sensitive audiences, including teenagers, okay? But you have to monitor these things and adapt. And the difficulty you appreciate is this kind of, how can I speak to adults and I make sure that kids don't have access and don't see it and you don't entice them? And the answer is obviously age limits, and there is debate in the US for increasing the age limit, but most importantly, it's access control at retail and strict contracts with retailers and potentially penalties, and governments can help here. And education at schools, as we were discussing before with Bo. You know, we told kids at school, including my own kids, don't smoke. And then you see kids coming back and say, I'm not smoking, I'm vaping. So we have to change the education and try to say, don't use nicotine products where you are young. They can have an impact potentially on your brain, and in any case, you know, it can get you into a habit you don't want to have. So we need to act on all these three items. And, you know, we have to admit that we can do this, and actually we have the proof it's feasible. It requires dialogue. But that should not become an excuse also that this product should not be available at all to anybody and have all the people who smoke today with no alternative. Because this debate still continues. We still have a number of NGOs that are against these products. And my question is, and then what? I mean, what if we give no alternative and we hope people will quit? Yes, maybe one day they will quit all, but there are still 1 billion people out there. So I think what we should be discussing is not whether alternatives should be made available. We don't have this debate about electric cars. We don't have this debate about solar panels. We don't. Now, solar panels are not exactly zero impact on the environment. They are better than fossil fuels, potentially, but they are not zero impact. Electric cars are not zero impact on the environment. Somebody has to build them, you need energy to produce them, you need batteries to be done. But are they better than burning fossil fuels everywhere? Yes, they are. Okay? So I think the discussion should be how best and how fast we should get these products and how I make sure consumers get the right information and are not misled. Because there has been a lot of controversy over the last few years about these products, as there is controversy in any new category. If there is anything new, there are people that are pro and con. But in any case, to me, it's only through working with the regulators that you can find solutions. And the industries in general, and our in particular, has to be much more collaborative, but the regulators also need to, you know, play the game and have the, you know, the dialogue so and the right measures. So I think I spoke enough. I'm sure there will be questions about our internal transformation later because that's of interest to everybody. But I hope I gave you the context, so we open now for questions.
Thank you, Andre. I have a question I think that all of us in business face as technology disrupts our business. Was it how many thousands of people? 77,000 people, and many of them grew up with the old business of tobacco. Mm-hmm. You're trying to transform it. How do you get people to embrace the new technology and help move you forward versus trying to protect the past?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, in particular, you know, we all know in not fast-moving, fast-paced businesses, and ours was no much innovation so many years. First of all, you develop a lot of generalists because you rotate people. And you have a leadership style where, as naturally, the more you go up the ranks, the more experience you get, the more you know. So you have the tendency to tell people how to do things. And all of a sudden, we discovered ourselves. We have life sciences. Not many people in Philip Morris knew much about it. They're not subject matter experts. We have a lot of electronics, connectivity, consumer interfaces, you know, user experience, reverse supply logistic chains, you name it. I mean, you come from the electronics industry, you know that very well. We had real-time communications in marketing, consumer journey rather than transactional. So the answer to that is you need the right balance between people you bring from the outside that are the subject matter experts, and you need to do it fast enough. I don't think I've done it fast enough, and there's no CEO I've talked to in transformation that said we did it fast enough. Because we all have the emotional link to our people, and sometimes the hope that over time they will learn. And probably good people, over time they will learn. But you cannot be a subject matter expert immediately, and time in today's world is a luxury we don't all have. I mean, what we could wait, as you very well know, for 5 years to happen, now it happens in 5 weeks or 5 months. So speed is very important. And then it's the management style. You know, how many times I go home and I say, gee, I don't know how to do this. I have no clue how to do this. Recognizing you don't know, despite I've spent 35 years in this industry, is very important. And then ask the right questions and have the right people to get things done and organize differently. I mean, we were a very vertical, siloed organization. Not very siloed, because you didn't even need to do project work to develop a new product, because the whole story was well known. Many people had done it so many times. And now you have to put cross-functional people on almost everything you do. So our job is to bring the people in and integrate them and start top down, in my view. If you start in the middle, it doesn't work very well. And over time, people learn, but you need a sufficient number of people to learn. When it comes to manufacturing, probably this is the least of the problem when you talk to 77,000 people, because you can teach people to utilize new machines. Of course, they're much more strict. They're almost pharma norms you apply to avoid variability of the product, but people learn. When it comes to marketing functions, sales functions, real-time communications, real-time marketing, that's where people, if they don't know how to do it, they've not done it, you lose a lot of time. And that's my lesson. But it's a completely different company you go in and a completely different operating speed. And I'm not saying we've done it. I don't think we will ever get it done, but I think we're becoming every day much better. I don't know who decides about the questions. Please go ahead.
You can't see me, but here we go. I'm over here. How has the marijuana industry impacted your company and the transformation that you're leading?
Didn't I know I'm going to get this question? I know it's the flavor of the month. Look, cigarettes are not particularly impacted by cannabis or marijuana. I think more the alcohol businesses are impacted. But here is my, you know, the way I would answer this question at this stage. I think, if I become a bit technical, in the cannabis marijuana business, and people confuse the two, and the active substances and everything, and I'm by and large not a subject matter expert, okay. Either you have a product that has therapeutical or preventive, you know, attributes, and then automatically in this country, if I'm not mistaken, and in many other, you are under FDA jurisdiction or the equivalent of other countries. And when we see the amount of claims people make about the product, I'm not saying they're right or wrong. Empirically, there is evidence that there are positive effects, but they are not substantiated in any acceptable way by regulators today. So there is a risk there of claims that are unsubstantiated. And when small businesses do this is one thing, when big businesses start getting into this is a different discussion, which automatically brings you to the pharma route, because then you need to decide whether the effects are verifiable in the clinic, what is the dose, what is the dosage, you know, the percentage between CBD and THC and so on. And then you have to go to doctors because they have to prescribe. So you're in the pharma business. And somebody has to decide whether you're in the pharma business or not. Okay. And then there is a consumer route, where to me the big question is first, what warning you give to people. If there is one experience I have from the cigarette industry, that failure to warn is not something that is a problem immediately, but you can be very well accused of failing to warn, of side effects, of anything, and you have to do this very carefully. So that has to be taken into consideration at the preamble. If I look now at the economics, that is more of interest to investment banks and investors, for the ones in the room, clearly this market will develop. There will be probably a lot of fragmentation in this market initially, because there is no product differentiation, there is no product brand differentiation, very much what happened in the e-vapor category and many others I can state. And then there will be consolidation, there will be regulation, there will be taxation, because any product that has some effect on people, government sooner or later come and tax it. And we're still having parallel channels open from the time the products were not legal. So I have to take all this into consideration. In my particular context, I have to take two other considerations. We have a very important task to accomplish by moving, switching people out of cigarettes to these new products. And, you know, at this stage, I don't think it's very intelligent for us to even think of any disruption in whatever other business, because that's the task at hand. And also, we should not forget we're an international, multinational company. We're operating in countries where there is zero consensus about cannabis or anything of this nature. And that's how we looked at this. And, you know, of course, we're instructing ourselves, because we have life sciences, to understand how these products are, but there is no plan to enter this category today as far as PMI is concerned. But we'll see the potential of the categories. Clearly, if these products verify the promise they give, there will be a market for them. That's undeniable.
Hi, I'm Jean McGinnis from the Shriners Hospitals for Children in Boston. I'm fascinated by the fact that you're here telling us a whole new way of thinking for a cigarette company, right? And I'm curious whether, since you've been there for a long time, if there was a moment in history or a story that you tell about the moment in history when everything changed.
Look, I don't think there is a moment in history. In my own mind, you know, I believe in people's free choice, but at the same time, I believe that if we have a product that has an impact on people, and cigarettes have the highest probably, then you have to do something about the product as soon as you can, and you have the technology to do it. So I don't think this was some moment of illumination when you say, now I'm going. I started this process when I became president of PMI, when PMI was part of the bigger group with Kraft. Okay, that was probably the first time I had the opportunity personally to do it, but it's not that I had opposition internally not to do it. I think the most important moment was much later, once we knew we have pretty good products, and we have the science as perfect as that can be. And then the decision is, do you treat this as an additional product in your portfolio, or you go full-heartedly on this? And my experience has been that if you do this, you know, I do a less sugar product, but I'll do my marketing, it doesn't work, tough luck. I'm not saying it's gonna work, but the key decision was to focus the organization, this is what we're going to do. and we focus solely on lease. Okay, let's not give away the existing business because still finances, and if I don't sell cigarettes, somebody else is going to sell them in any case. But let's focus on this. The second important decision was, do we keep this as in one organization with all the caveats it has in re-educating people, changing the culture internally on how to work, not the principle. I can tell you everybody in Philip Morris International who has got the new product has got, you know, immediately behind them. So do we keep this as a separate entity? Do you spin it off one day, or you try to do everything actually from the beginning? And there are pros and cons on this. As you all know, I'm not going to give you lessons. I mean, yes, you can go faster. Yes, you can recruit better people. But at the same time, you don't have the enormous infrastructure and firepower you have in 185 markets. I don't think we would have ever scaled this product with all the defects we have and lack of digital systems and modernity if we didn't have the size of this enterprise. Now, history will prove whether I was right or wrong. Okay, I cannot prove it to you, but I think I thought for all the people in this company that had worked for so many years, and also, you know, I don't want to leave them behind. The ones who will make it eventually are worth the effort. And maybe I'm emotional about this, but when you have worked with people so many years, you give them a chance. So that was the two more defining moments, I think. The board was in perfect agreement, no problem. Shareholders, okay, initially they understood. There is, of course, volatility in this new category, so we have a bit of jitter and share going up and down. That's fine. I think to me, we are getting okay with the transformation of the company after what I described. The key problem is to move the emotional debate between ourselves, people in public health, and NGOs, from what I call sometimes too ideological, or sometimes, sorry to say that, childish almost, because whether we have a fight between Philip Morris and ex-NGO, or between Y company and ex-NGO, frankly speaking, this is not going to change the behavior of one smoker in the world because that passes over their heads. So whomever wants to help, they can get their sleeves up and come and help. Because it's not easy to convince people to switch, believe me. It's very tough. But no defining moment, a lot of pain and work. And I would say one thing, consistency of the message. Because we started this journey, and for most people in the company, this was R&D doing this thing in a corner, and they are hearing from time, also for patent and confidentiality reasons. But stay the course. Once we have them, that's where we go. That's where we go. And even when you have to make all the arbitrages of resources, because I told you 60% of the money is already there, but you have to do it market by market. People who run markets have to deliver bottom lines. They have to deal with both categories. So there's not easy moments all the time. But the consistency of the message is very important for the organization, and that's what I perceive my role. Yes, I'm an old-timer in this company, and newcomers know better certain technical things, but they don't know the history, and we should never lose the history and all the controversy and everything. These mistakes should never be repeated, whatever the mistakes were, on both sides, on regulators, on us, on whatever. And the second thing is to understand a very complex regulatory landscape. And somebody that comes from the outside has no exposure to these things. They come to this industry and they think, you know, that you can do marketing like you do in normal products. So they need to learn. And that's a little bit my role as I perceive it.
Hi, my question is influenced by a movie I saw recently, and I want to know what your end game is. So when you're actively trying to have your customers stop using your product, you're giving them an alternative solution, what's in the future? Are you, you know, what what do you want your customers' behavior to be in the future? Stop using one product, but the other one is a substitution. So what's comes next?
Look, I think, first of all, if we look at the bigger picture, you know, it will take a lot of time to convince people, and with regulatory help, we can go there faster. For me, it makes sense, even if I talk about the existing product categories broadly defined as nicotine or as you ask questions, let's say one day broadly defined even that. Even alkaloids, whatever it is, benevolent or not harmful alkaloids. At the end of the day, you know, my view is people engage in a lot of not very healthy behaviors. And you can expand your scope over time beyond nicotine. Once you have consumers that you have convinced once to do something, and by the way, we observe that when people switch out of cigarettes, they also go to better diet, they start exercising again because their exercising capacity obviously improves, so you have no carbon monoxide and so on. There are opportunities once you have people in your databases and you gain some degree of trust and permission, you can add services or products over time. So you reduce your dependence on revenues on one category, okay? I perceive today that if we assume there are at least current generation of smokers, many people who will not switch, who will not quit, I'm sorry. So I think at least I have to offer them the product, explain to them, try my best to convince them. If they don't, at the end of the day, people have free will, whether we want to admit it or not. And that's what we're doing. Do I believe that in 10 years from now there will be no smokers in the world? Maybe 10 years, no, but we can get to a very large part of people having switched. But in 20 years, we can very well achieve this. And there are many countries that declare they want to be smoke-free by then, X year. Now, without very concrete measures, so this is an additional help to get them there. And in between, we can always diversify our business. But for the moment, as I said, we have 28% of the international market, 15% of the world market. I think I can get a lot of market share with these products and make shareholders happy without worrying what is going to be the after. But we should prepare the after as well.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring Andre Collinsopoulos, CEO of Philip Morris International. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.